and it was a late night. How many of you got to bed before 1 o'clock? Wow. Yeah, I'm surprised anyone. The bishops are like, yes. Anyone over the age of 35 did? Beyond that, I'm not real sure. So how many, did anyone stay up past 2? What were you guys doing? Or should I even ask? All right, let's all bow our heads. We'll have a confession at this point in time. All right, for those that stay, and I also noticed that there's a lopsidedness to the room this morning. That, you know, the seemingly, like, those that stayed up late and partied are on this side. All those who love God and are mentally and spiritually prepared for the word this morning would be on. No. What I want to do this morning is I really want to go right into the word. We're going to pick it up. And as I said last night, our ultimate goal here is really to just address the question of how can I glorify God in every decision I make? Recognizing that going into it, one is that God actually has a right to have input on every decision that we make. We don't have the option of cutting him out. We don't have the option of saying, I'll just do what everyone else is doing. We don't have the option of saying, I'm going to do what I want to do. That God has a voice in all decision making. And because of that, we have to have a sensitivity, a heart sensitivity, an ear sensitivity to what God says on specific issues. Now, the beauty of this is we don't have to be, you know, a kooky or weird about this. And walk in nature and say, okay, God, what are you saying? What are you saying? I'm listening. That God has already said what needs to be said on every decision we have in life. And so our task is just to see, God, what have you said? And then give me wisdom as far as implementation is concerned. So that's kind of our big perspective. We're going to push toward that. We're actually not going to get to the final principle until maybe early this evening. Right now, I just want to kind of pick up where we left off, and we're just going to plow through the scriptures more than anything else. And if you're willing, again, Keith mentioned last night, I'm not sure what your expectations were. I enjoy this. And so if you'll work with me, I enjoy just opening the text of Scripture and just talking through it with a group of fellow believers and thinking through it. And this morning, and even a little bit in the second session, we're going to have to do some plow work. And then after that, we'll do some application and we'll go from there. All right, real quick, review. And we weren't that far away from last night, so we don't have to spend a lot of time here. All right, dealing with the world. Challenges, how can I be against the world and yet for the world? How can I balance isolation versus assimilation? How can I be a friend to sinners and yet separated from the world? How can I handle personal, individual, soul liberty and at the same time have Christian community sensitivity as far as process is concerned? I know that every decision I make, the commands of God are dominant. That's my starting point and my stopping point. If God says, thus saith, then that's it for me. But a mature believer understands biblical principles, is looking for biblical examples, and then is ascertaining the character of God as he makes decisions. Three questions as far as the Corinthians are wrestling with here. One is, can I go to an idolatrous feast and eat the meat? Their argument is simply this. A stick's a stick, a stone's a stone, a steak's a steak. All things are lawful unto me. I should be able to eat whatever I want to, wherever I want to. All right, that's their question number one. Question number two, what if that same piece of meat is in the shambles, in the marketplace? Can I eat it then? And then question number three, what if I go to an unbeliever's home and he serves me a steak? Then what am I supposed to do? How do I respond to that? Okay, now we already know the answers to those. Cautions. Caution number one, debatable things are not answered simply because Paul's goal was not merely right action. None of us want to be biblical autotrons where it's just everything, we're just told exactly what to think. And quite honestly, sometimes, and I don't know your individual backgrounds, but sometimes we can come from a background that is like that. Right? Don't think, just do. Now, there is a place for that when you're dealing with children. And many of you are looking forward to parenthood. And as you get into that parenthood mode, you'll realize that there are basically three stages. Ages 0 through 12, you have control. It wasn't that long ago, I was in a grocery store, and a mother was there, and she had two children. I would have guessed their ages to be maybe 4 and 2. And they were in the cereal aisle. Okay, now the cereal aisle to me is an amazing aisle. I love going there and just standing and watching all the pretty colors and everything that's there. And there are so many different kinds. So she has this 4-year-old and this 2-year-old, and I was there getting something else, and she said, okay, now each one of you can pick 3 boxes of cereal and put it in the cart. And I stopped for a moment, and my back was turning. I heard her say that. I went, oh, I got to watch this. And so yeah, I'm just kind of, you know, looking at whatever I was looking at going, and these kids were just all over the place, knocking cereal over. One would grab a box. The other one would grab it and say, no, that's mine. They ended up with like 8 boxes, and she'd be putting them back. And they ended up crying. I was thinking, you don't give choices of cereals to 2- and 4-year-olds. It doesn't work that way. Right? In parenting, you have control basically from 0 to 12. 13 to 18, you go from control to coaching. Right? At a coaching level, you have the playbook. Okay? You know what the rules are. And you can pull the players off the court if you want to. You can leave them on the court. You're still very much, from a coaching perspective, running the game. At the same time, a good coach knows that they want their point guard to be able to function independently. All right, Sports Illustration for those that follow. You want your best players out there, and the older they get, you want to give them more and more and more freedom so that they can develop their individualized skills. All right, that's coaching. That's basically 12 to 18 or so. Starting about 19 and going up, you go from control to coaching now to counselor. And all of a sudden, they start, you know, you start asking your parents questions, and your parents don't say, this is what you should do. They start saying, well, what do you think? You know, you need to make that decision. Now, I realize that in a group like this, some of you, as you sit there, you go, can you please tell that to my parents? Okay? My parents still think I'm 11. And so they tell me everything. And others of you are in a situation where you go, I want someone to tell me everything. And I remember, again, I was 20, first major decision I had to make as far as life. And I called my dad and I said, Dad, what do you think? And my dad was usually pretty good about telling me exactly what he thought. And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I'm not sure. Just, you know, tell me yes or no. And he said, I'm not going to tell you. Your decision, your consequences. Make the call. And I went, wow. And they were developing within me the ability. And they had developed, and they were continuing to allow me to make choices. Right? That's that stage. What Paul is doing with the Corinthians here is he's not dealing with them at a control level or even at a coaching level. He's dealing with them at a counseling level where he's saying, okay, now here are the principles. Now you make the call. And within making that call, there's some individuality that's expressed here. So debatable things cannot be answered simply. Number 2, debatable things cannot be answered absolutely. And we looked at this is where we closed last night. The 3 questions. Can I go to an idolatrous feast? Answer is absolutely not. 2nd question. Can I eat the meat if it's sold in the marketplace? Answer is absolutely yes. 3rd question. Can I eat the meat if I go to an unbeliever's home? And the answer is, well, maybe. It all depends on what the dinner conversation is. So, the final question we ended with last night was simply this. Why is Paul flip-flopping in his answers? Let's go back into the text. We'll see if we can answer that. All right. Chapter 10. 1 Corinthians. Let's pick it up with the unbeliever's home. And let's see if we can develop the argument that is here. He says this, picking it up in verse 25. Whatever is sold in the shambles, that eat, asking no questions for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. You go to the market, you pick up the steak, you take it home, you throw it on the Weber grill, a little bit of seasoning, medium rare, put it on the plate. Right before you bite into it, you say, Lord, thank you that you have given me all things to enjoy freely, and the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and I am eating because you own everything. Go to the unbeliever's home, verse 27. Any of them believe not, bid you to a feast, and you be disposed to go, whatever is set before you, ask, eat, asking no questions for conscience sake. Exact same scenario, there it is sitting, you bite into that steak, no one says anything, you're good. Verse 28, but if any man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat not, for his sake that showed it. So, you're sitting at the table, you bite into that steak, you take a piece out of that steak, and you start enjoying it, and you go, that is the absolute best steak I have ever had. Where did you get this? And he says, man, I got this down at Joe's Idol Shop. I mean, you don't shop there? It's down on the corner, Broadway and Main. That is the absolute best steak you could ever imagine. Comes right out of the temple. They hang it right on the hooks. You beat the flies off of it. Man, marinate it, and it is fantastic. Right, the minute he says that, you take your plate and you push it away. And you push it away because the rest of the verse says, because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Now, this is the exact same piece of steak that you, if you took it home, you're fine with. This is the exact same piece of steak that if you never ask him, you could enjoy. But the minute he says he got it down at Joe's Idol Shop, you've got to push it away. Now, my question is this, why? Why? And think about the verse he's using. Because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And read the context. He says, it's not for your conscience sake. Verse 29, not thine own, but of the other. So it is for the conscience of the unbeliever that you are pushing this away. Little input. Some of you were thinking here. Why are you pushing it away? Why are you pushing it away? What makes that stake off limits when that conversation takes place?
Is it because the unbeliever is viewing it as part of worship to his God, so he sees you as that?
Okay. The minute he says that steak came from Joe's Idol Shop, and you take a bite of it, and you say, this is good stuff, then what you are acknowledging his God. And the reality is, that steak was provided by who? God. And when he acknowledges that steak from his God, then you have to push it away because you do not want to give credence to his idea that that steak coming from that idol shop has any merit to it at all. So if you eat that steak, then what you're saying is this. That steak has partial ownership by someone who is not Yahweh, if I can define God in those terms. That is not Jehovah. All right, no conversation taking place. In your heart, you can enjoy it and you can say, this is unto God, no questions asked. He enters someone else into the equation, Joe's Idol Shop. Suddenly, God is sharing the credit for that piece of meat. And you go, nope, God's not going to share any credit with this. This is God's and God's alone. So, I'm not eating it if you, as an unbeliever, credit it to a lifestyle that is marked by the world. Not going there. Now, that's the thinking. We're going to have to come back to this because, by the way, that key verse that we've talked about, verse 31, whether therefore you eat or drink, or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God, that's the tail end of this argument. Right, that specific argument about being at an unbeliever's home. So we got to flesh that out in just a moment here. Let's address the question, why is Paul flip-flopping in his answer? And to do that, let's go back into the Old Testament stories that are told here. Chapter 10, the first 15 verses, we looked at it just broadly last night, noting that they are Old Testament illustrations. Look at some of the development, again, of Paul's argument. I want us to think in terms of big picture here. Verse 1, moreover, brother, I would not that ye be ignorant. How that? And you're going to catch a key word here. How that all of our fathers were under the sea, all were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, and they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. So what Paul's doing here is he's saying, all right, Corinthians, in this whole issue of meat offered unto idols, let's go back Old Testament Exodus. In the Old Testament Exodus, let's see what we can find by way of illustrations that will help us understand this contemporary issue that they're dealing with. Obviously, what he's emphasizing here is five privileges. All of them had this, all of them had that, all of them had this, and it's just, you know, constant memory of all. Give me a rough number. How many children of Israel actually left Egypt out of the Exodus? All right, we'll say somewhere maybe between 1.5 to 2 million people, somewhere in that number, okay? That's how many people left. And what Paul is saying is he's saying all of these people had all of these privileges. And then there is this massive, hilarious statement that many of us miss. It is Paul's sarcastic humor. It's kind of like his understated humor. The verse says this, "But with many of them, God is not well pleased." Do you sense any humor there? Out of the 1.5 to 2 million that left Egypt, how many over the age of 20 made it into the promised land? Two. You got to catch what Paul's doing here. It's actually funny. He's saying, now, all of these people had all these privileges. Oh, but by the way, many of them, God was not well pleased. How about about 1.5 million of them, God was not well pleased. And their bodies were strewn throughout the wilderness. And so you have this five failures. Most of them died. It's fun to do the numbers. And if you take out the major episodes that happened in that 40 years of wilderness wandering, if you take the total number of the children of Israel that were actually leaving, and I had an Old Testament professor do this, he told me that there was something in the realm of 213 funerals every single day. Now you stop and think about that. And most of you have seen like ancient Near Eastern funerals, or at least you've seen Near Eastern funerals, where what they do is, you know, the body is wrapped up really quickly and everyone's yelling and they're throwing things in the air. You know, the Hebrew people are these very emotional people. So roughly, you know, 220, 215 times a day within the camp of Israel, someone comes out of their tent and they're screaming that someone has died. And they wrap the body up and the whole family gathers around and they're dressed in sackcloth and ashes and they're moaning and they're weeping and there's wailing of teeth. And then the shovel committee comes and they all run out into the desert and they dig a shallow grave. They throw the body in, they cover it up, and then they run back in. And the minute they get back in, someone else is doing the exact same thing 220 times a day. That's what's happening within the camp. Hey, by the way, that's called a visual illustration from God. Israel, next time you get to the River Jordan, I would strongly encourage you to cross. Okay? That is kind of a hint from God that for 40 years, this is what you're going to endure, so the next time you get there, take a step of faith and trust me. So, Paul's argument is, all right, most of them had all these privileges, most died. Principle is simply this. Don't think that your spiritual position or heritage will protect you from the dangers of desiring things that could result in spiritual suicide. Israel had all of these spiritual privileges, and yet in the midst of all of these spiritual privileges, they made really poor decisions. Corinthians. I've already told you in chapter 1 that there is no church in the entire Asia Minor area that is more gifted than you are. You have all knowledge. You have all spiritual gifts. Don't think for a moment, Corinthians, just because you have all of these abilities that you won't make decisions that were going to result in spiritual suicide. You don't want your body to be strewn across the wilderness. Now, at a contemporary level, we have all of these spiritual privileges. We have all of these spiritual gifts at an individual basis. Quite honestly, we have more spiritual knowledge and information available to us than any generation that has ever preceded us. We are a gifted lot. Don't think for a moment that all of that is going to protect you from decisions that will result in spiritual suicide. Now again, remember what we're talking about here. We're talking about, where can you eat meat? And Paul says that if you don't include God in that decision, your body could be strewn across the wilderness. Right? That's the analogy he's drawing. Keep walking through the passage. Verse 6. Now, these things were an example to the intent like. Now, what Paul's going to do is he's actually going to give you five Old Testament illustrations all born out of the Exodus. He's going to give them in sentence fashion. Number one, to the intent that, number, we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be idolaters, as some of them were, as it was written. The people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day, 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of you also, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. So what he's doing is he's taking five Old Testament illustrations and he's pulling them out and he's saying, okay, don't be like they are. We don't have time to look at all of them. We're just going to look at one of the illustrations. We'll start with the very beginning one. Go back with me. Keep your finger in 1 Corinthians and go back with me to the book of Numbers. The very first thing that he says here is he says, don't lust after evil things. So we're going to go back to the book of Numbers, chapter 11, and we're going to pull that exact phrase out of the Old Testament passage that Paul's addressing here. Story is, the people are complaining about food. Huh. That's why Paul's using this as an illustration. He's saying, all right, Corinthians, you're complaining about food. Let's go back to the Old Testament and let's find out what we can learn about people complaining about food. Picking up in about verse 4. And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. That's his term. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlics. But now our soul is dried up, and there's nothing beside this manna before our eyes. And manna was coriander seed and was like bdellum. All right, let's stop and think for a moment here. By the way, I do find it interesting that they were tired of manna. Don't necessarily know this, so I'll just throw this out. As a Hebrew scholar, manna, is actually, if you transliterate it in the Hebrew, it actually comes out as Krispy Kreme. And so that's what they were enjoying. His Krispy Kreme, hot donuts now, every single morning. And how could life get any better than that? They were tired of the manna. And the complaint is simply this. We want the same things that we had when we were in Egypt. So a couple questions, and let's just kind of think through the questions here. What was the moral character of the things that the people desired? All right, go back into the text. What were the people desiring?
Food.
Name this specific food. Verse 5.
Fish.
What else?
Garlic.
Cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions. Okay, let's stop for a moment. Cucumber. Okay, now don't go back into vegetaire mode. Okay, what was it? Was it Bob the cucumber?
Larry.
Yeah, I knew some of you would know. All right, it's Saturday morning, so we're all sitting, we're watching VeggieTales. No. Larry the cucumber here. Now, take Larry's persona out of this, and we'll just kind of take this one. Who can catch here? Good duck. All right, question for you. What is the moral character of that cucumber?
There isn't
one. No, seriously, what is the moral character of that cucumber?
Nice.
Moral character of the cucumber. Is it good or is it evil? Just a cucumber. All right, talk to the cucumber. See if it has any sense of... All right, it's just a cucumber. All right, is there any moral character to a cucumber? Answer?
No.
Is there any moral character to a melon?
No.
No, or garlic, unless, you know, like you're on your way to a date. Basically, no. There's no moral character at all. So, they are morally neutral items. Now, this is what I want you to do. Keep your finger there. Go back with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And I want you to tell me why Paul's wrong. Or tell me why Paul's right. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He says this, verse 6, that we should not lust after What's the next phrase? Evil things, as they also lusted. All right, give me the cucumber back. Caleb, you got it? Paul calls this evil. You called it neutral. So, my question is simply this. What gives Paul the right to call this an evil cucumber? Okay, now to answer the question, you got to go back to the Numbers passage. Okay, look at the Numbers passage and tell me, what gives Paul the right to call this an evil cucumber? What's it say?
In this passage, they're complaining to God. They're being ungrateful for what God's given them. And I don't know if they do it in this passage, but most of the time when they ran out of food or water, they would accuse God and Moses of being genocidal maniacs.
Okay. So there's a lack of contentment with what God has provided them. They're tired of the manna. Keep looking in the text.
Part of it, too, is they're associating Egypt as a place where they can, have happiness and contentment, and Egypt was not a place that worshipped God by any means. So just with the association, I think, is what Paul's doing.
Okay, exactly. I'm going to stop and think for a moment. Did God have a problem with the children of Israel eating cucumbers when they were in Egypt? Answer?
No.
Does God have a problem with the children of Israel eating cucumbers when they get to the promised land?
No.
It's not an issue, right? Cucumber is a morally neutral thing. In Egypt, it was acceptable. In the promised land, he has no problem with them eating cucumbers. But in this context, they were lusting after things and they were associating them with Egypt-like living. Let's develop the principle. We'll see if we can go there from there. Second question, what made these things evil? They were associated with Egypt-like living. God, why can't I have these things which we did eat in Egypt freely? Now, big principle here that Paul's working toward. It's a key principle in our understanding of the passage. And simply this, morally neutral things can be characterized as evil via their association with the world. Morally neutral things can be characterized as evil via their association with the world. Don't miss this. Let's see if I can add this at a contemporary level. A t-shirt, morally good, morally evil. Answer? Morally neutral. Can a t-shirt be characterized as evil via its association with the world? Yes. Yes. Thus, God has input into even the t-shirts that we wear. Meat. Let me go back to the 1 Corinthians situation. Can meat be characterized as evil via its association with the world? Answer? Yes. This is the point that Paul's trying to make with them. In the temple, you can't eat it because associations do matter. In the shambles, you're going to take it home. It has no association in that setting. Eat it. When you're at an unbeliever's home, eat it. There's no association with it. The minute he associates it with something in the world, you push it away. So, morally neutral things, several of the things which we talked about last night, and you could add to that list, can be characterized as evil via their association with the world. Oh, by the way, those exact same things can be morally neutral again if there's no association. Right, this is what Paul's getting them to think through. So caution number one is debatable things can't be answered simply. Caution number two is debatable things can't be answered absolutely. Caution number three, and this is where we'll end this morning, is debatable things can't be answered arrogantly. Debatable things can't be answered arrogantly. We're just going to look at one passage of Scripture. I'm going to bring it down to Paul's illustrations at the end of chapter 9. And we're not going to go through all of chapter 9. But let's just focus on his concluding thoughts here. Back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, passage of scripture that we're familiar with. He's giving all these illustrations, used the word I 35 times. Verse 24, now you know that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain. And everyone that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Here's his final application of his illustration. I therefore so run, not as uncertainty. So fight I, not as one that beats there, but I keep my body under and I bring it into subjection, lest by any means when I have preached to others, I myself would be a castaway. Hey, simple question here. If there's anyone who has the spiritual maturity to handle debatable issues, would you define it as Paul or the Corinthians? If there's anyone that can handle getting close to the line, it's clearly Paul. And what is his response when it comes to these decisions? He says, I beat myself up. The text literally says, I give myself a black eye. I keep my body under and I bring it into subjection. It has the idea of a fist being formed and he hits himself. So every time he comes to these decisions and he has to weigh out in his own heart which way he's going to go, he says, I have to beat myself. I have to die to myself. I used to have a pastor who said this. He said, Brian, anytime when you come to one of these, a decision like this, just look at what's in your heart and do 180 degrees the opposite way. And I'll be honest with you, when I heard that, I went, that's an overstatement. That's just not right. I'm not that bad. You know, I've got some common sense. For the most part, I can make these decisions. Man, the more I think about that, the more I realize that in my heart of hearts, he's dead on. Get to the things and then beat myself. What Paul's concerned about here is, in the verse 27, lest I be a castaway. Right, the word is a dokimos, and sometimes I don't throw original words out, but this is a really cool one. If you were to go into the city of Corinth, there being Agora, which is the marketplace, and in the marketplace, at the end of the marketplace, it's actually an ancient place where we've excavated, and you can see these things. There's a bema seat that's there where the judgment is. There's a marketplace that's there, and there's a kind of like a concrete stand, a stone stand. And we actually have pictures of the balance that was there. And what the marketeers would do is, as they would be in the Agora, many of them would have a little pouch that would be strapped underneath their clothing. And of course, they were dealing in real gold and real silver back then. And so someone would come by and they'd buy, you know, a dozen cucumbers and they'd hand you a piece of gold and you put it in your pocket. Well, what the charlatans would do is they take that little piece of gold and they just take a knife and they just skim the edge off of that piece of gold or the edge off of that piece of silver into their little pouch. Now, if you're handling 200 coins a day and every single one of those coins, you just take a little edge off of that, your little pouch is full of little gold and silver shavings. You do that in the course of the week and you're kind of, it's like a tip jar. You can kind of define it like that. So these guys were tipping themselves. The problem with that is that when multiple individuals were doing it, what was happening to the size of a quarter? It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what they would do is they'd actually take the coins and they would take it down to the magistrate, down to the bema seat, and they would have the real size or the real weight of what a gold coin would be, and they'd have to put their coinage on the other side. And if the coinage was found not weighty enough, if it didn't merit the fullness as far as the weight, if too much had been shaved off, the Roman magistrate would take the coin off, it would actually stamp the coin, a dokimos. That was the word that was used. It meant to take something out of circulation. It meant that it was found in the balance and it wasn't weighty enough. It failed the test. That's the word that Paul uses here. It's connecting with the Corinthians. They know exactly what he's talking about. So what Paul is saying is this. He's saying, when I get to this issue of debatable things, trust me, if anyone can handle it, I can handle it. That's his whole argument in 35, or in chapter 9, in those 35 eyes. But he says, but when I face these things, I beat myself because I don't want to be taken out of circulation. I don't want to be removed from ministry. So what he's saying is simply this. The Corinthians are saying, listen, I have knowledge. And Paul says, listen, the determining factor is not your knowledge. They're saying, we have rights. And he's saying, the determining factor is not your rights. I can handle it. The determining factor is not your ability to handle it. I like it. The determining factor is not whether you like it or not. It works. The determining factor is not whether it works or not. When we have to make decisions, we don't make decisions purely from the position of knowledge, rights, reason, pragmatism, personal choice, whether I like it or not. Paul says when you face these issues, you've got to stop and you've got to realize that there is a larger principle you've got to think through other than self. Okay? Three cautions. Now, what we need to do in our next session, I've told you everything what not to do to a certain extent, because that's what Paul does. He says you can't do it this way. Now, thankfully, he does give us principles on how to make decisions. And we'll start that next session. And we'll just start in chapter 8. We'll go all the way and find 10 principles through the end of chapter 10. So hopefully it'll be fun. All right? We're just going to pray. And I feel like right in the middle here. And that's okay. We'll stop right in the middle and we'll pick it up in about 45 minutes or so. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for your goodness. And we would pray that as we continue to think and as we engage our mind into Scripture, that your Spirit would be able to use it to challenge us and to conform us so that our thinking is your thinking and that our decision-making includes you. And we'll give you thanks in your name. Amen.